Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we talk with Fresno City Councilmember Clint Olivier, who is bringing back a proposal that would legalize marijuana operations in the city. This just 3 months after the city council said no to commercial marijuana dispensaries. Does he have the votes? And would a plan that wins city council approval survive a potential veto from Mayor Brand? We'll ask those questions and find out his thoughts about a proposal from one of his colleagues to give city council members a raise. Later in the show, we'll learn why students in the CSU system are growing increasingly concerned about the rise in student fees and why a recent vote at Fresno State might be a harbinger of things to come system-wide. We begin today's show, though, looking at air quality. If you've ever gotten a speeding ticket, you may have been required to attend traffic school. Likewise, cause a scene at work, and you may have to take anger management classes. But what if you violate burning restrictions? FM 89's Carrie Klein reports on a different kind of class intended to spark good behavior.
On damp, chilly nights in Fresno, Patrick Smith has a tradition. He builds a fire in his fireplace.
So typically what I'll do is I'll take the ashes out, put them into a bucket.
Smith lives in northwest Fresno.
And so kindling...
A gas-powered furnace heats his home, but Smith still thinks of a fire as a gathering place for his family.
It's nice to have the warmth, the crackle, the sound, the sight, even a little bit of the smell, the flavor of a fire in the home.
Today, he's not actually going to light this fire. It's a no-burn day. Smith knows this because he checks the San Joaquin Valley Air District's website to know when the air is clean enough for wood burning. One day last winter, though, he didn't check. It was raining, and he assumed it was safe to burn. It wasn't.
It was, in fact, no-burn day, and I'm thinking somebody must have objected to that, recognized that, and called in a complaint.
The Air District busted him. They sent him a letter with a choice. He could pay a $100 fine or pay $50 and attend a class. So he took the discount. And last week, he attended Fireplace School.
Hello, welcome everybody to the Fireplace Compliance School. My name is Clay Bishop, and this is Patrick Houlihan.
Fireplace Compliance School, as it's formally called, is a remedial class at the Valley Air District's Fresno headquarters. It takes place in a conference room with big, cushy chairs and wide, flat-screen displays. Attendees video conference in from Modesto and Bakersfield.
So we're going to run through a couple topics, some brief history, some basics about air pollution.
The class is an opportunity for officials to hammer home their residential burning rule. From November through February, wood-burning fireplaces and fire pits can be used only on clear days with decent air quality.
So as the smoke comes out of your chimney, it's warm, obviously. It's going to travel up because it's warm and light in the cold air.
The class serves as Air Pollution 101. One of the focal points is a weather pattern called temperature inversions. In the wintertime, the air near the ground can actually be colder and denser than the atmosphere above it. That means smoke will stay near the ground instead of wafting up and away.
So it traps it. So that's why it's important to air pollution, especially in the wintertime.
Fireplace smoke is not the valley's only source of air pollution, but it's significant. The Air District estimates wood-burning smoke makes up about 13% of all wintertime particle pollution. Instructor Clay Bishop says cutting back wood-burning is one way residents can directly impact the air. Plus, for most people, not burning is easy and doesn't cost anything.
And it's quite impactful on air pollution. So we always look at it as a rule that it's a fairly cheap rule. People don't have to spend much money to be in compliance.
But it's not easy for everyone. Some Valley residents may have no other heat source. Others have broken furnaces and can't afford new ones. For them, the Air District will waive their fine and point them toward grants to help them upgrade to cleaner burning devices. But for those like Patrick Smith, who burn for pleasure, Bishop says the Air District is much more strict.
It's a really impactful rule for your neighborhood, if you want to look at it that way. It's one of these things where you're making a decision on an activity that could impact your neighbor's health.
The restrictions appear to be working. According to the Air District, wintertime pollution levels have dropped significantly since the rule was enacted in the 90s. So then, why go to the trouble of having a class? Compliance Officer Michael Carrera says the purpose is to get the word out. And for that, he says it's working.
Over the years, it's not that we've seen significant reductions in the number of penalties that we've had, but it's we don't have a lot of repeat offenders.
So I'll stack it up and make a little bit of a tower.
Patrick Smith does not want to be one of those repeat offenders. He says he'll definitely be more careful and check burn status more often.
Yeah, I don't want to have this happen again.
Besides, repeat violations get pretty pricey, and there's no discount for those. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The CSU system has been known for over 50 years as offering a good education at a good price. And while student fees have risen over the years, it still remains a relative higher education bargain. But that doesn't mean students on campuses like CSUB and Fresno State aren't feeling a financial pinch each semester. In fact, a new piece in the publication EdSource suggests a recent rejection of higher fees by the Fresno State student body might be a sign of things to come at CSU campuses statewide. Here to tell us more is Larry Gordon. He is a senior correspondent covering the world of higher education for EdSource. Larry, welcome.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
So this issue of student fees, you start your article out talking about what happened at Fresno State back in the spring. With the students' rejection of a new student union proposal, what's this all about?
Student unions have traditionally been built and run with monies that come from directly from the student's pocket, not funneled through tuition and not funneled through the state taxes. So this year they asked the students to kick in $400 extra a year. Wouldn't start until the building actually opened, but it came at the same time as the main tuition bill was going up, almost about the same amount. And it seemed at the time to be too much, you know, after 5 or 6 years of no tuition increase, and then suddenly tuition increase and this together. And I started hearing from students saying that, you know, they just didn't think it was fair. And at the trustees meeting, the system-wide board that governs the 23 CSUs, there had been several statements against these campus fees going up. And also, for the first time that I'd seen, a full publication of all the numbers and all the different causes that they support. And it really caught my attention that this is not just $20 here, $20 there. It's on average $1,400 at all the CSUs, and in some cases $3,000 at San Luis Obispo, on top of tuition, on top of the room and board, and on top of books.
So how does this issue of fees compare across the campuses of the CSU and then between the CSU system and, let's say, the UC?
Well, actually, Fresno, bless his heart, has among the lowest, I think the lowest, of the campus-based fees. I think it's in the $840 range right now. So this would have jacked it up to about $1,200. So Fresno has been pretty modest up until this point. Some of the others, you know, are already up there, up to, you know, Bakersfield's already at $1,400, and San Luis Obispo is $3,690. They've done a lot of auxiliary things there to help support some of their engineering and science functions. So oddly enough, the UCs tend to be often a little bit more modest than some of the CSUs, except for apparently Santa Barbara is the highest. That's now, I think, up to about $1,600.
And of course, at the UC, you have the issue of tuition, which is distinct from fees itself.
Right.
These are two separate categories, although it still hits the pocketbook.
And you see, you know, their mandatory tuition. They don't use the word fees anymore for what goes on in the classroom. They switched a few years to the reality-based word of tuition. That's now about $12,000 a year.
Now, the big discussion in higher education across the country right now is the cost and the increasing cost of higher ed. How does the CSU compare across the country? Is this something that is, you know, the leaders, you talk to Fresno State President Joseph Castro or CSUB President Horace Mitchell, they say we're still one of the most affordable, best bargains out there for higher education. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is true. I mean, you know, in the College Board annual survey, CSU does come across really well. And but so does the more important point, so does financial aid in California. You know, our CalGrant program is among the most generous in the country. But students and their advocates come back and say the cost of living here in many places is so much higher than other states that you can't just look at the tuition line. You have to look at what does it cost to eat, to live, to run a car, and things like that. And that, you know, once that's added in, it's not as great a bargain as it appears at first glance.
So this issue of the Fresno State Student Union is pretty clear cut. As you said, student unions traditionally have been paid for by student fees. Have there been instances where campuses have shifted the balance of programs that maybe used to be funded by the state and put those on the onus on students?
Yeah, about right after the financial collapse 10 years ago, there had been this shift to what they called student success fees. And they were kind of suspiciously close to what the state always had been funding. You know, they were going to issues like counseling and tutoring, and even on some campuses, actually wholeheartedly hiring professors. It caused a big ruckus both in the legislature and around the campuses. And a few years ago, the legislature actually put a temporary ban on any new of these so-called success fees and required that any of them require a full referendum of student votes to pass. So since then, they're continuing. They're still substantial at some school, but no new big ones have been added. And 12 of the 23 CSUs have them. Fresno does not.
So you write that this rejection of student fee increase for the student union at Fresno State may be evidence of a larger trend. Why is that?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's pretty rare that students will vote against an issue like this, particularly since they themselves, you know, if you're a junior or senior, it's pretty unlikely that you'll pay the fee. The building's going to probably take 3 to 4 years to design and build. So the fact that they voted against it, several student leaders have told me that, you know, they think that this could easily spread, you know, as things, if people start pushing fees that are jumping up this far. This is not just a $25 person fee to support concerts or support the student government. Now, this is a big jump. On the other hand, you know, the argument could be that if you look at San Francisco State, they had quite a big jump there, partly to improve subsidies for transit for the Muni and the BART system there. And that passed, even with students who might have to still pay for their own parking pass, they still voted for it.
So students at Fresno State may have rejected the call in March of 2017 to fund this new student union, but that's not the end of that issue. It's coming back.
No, it's not over. No, they're coming back. Student government and the administration have worked on coming up with a slightly altered plan. They promised to be coming back this upcoming March with another referendum, lowering the cost to about 300, dropping it by about 100, trying it again, claiming that they're going to do much more private fundraising, maybe get $15 million or so from private sources, and also redesigning the building a bit and putting some more goodies that might be appeal to students. I was told even certain kind of nap module areas. You know, I know it's pretty hard. There's a lot of students who, you know, they're juggling from work to school and working crazy hours, and, you know, they might want to take a little snooze, you know, right there and not disrupt people in the library. And, you know, and other things, putting more services directly in that building. So it's going to be interesting, and only a year has gone by, and the people who are opposed to it are still opposed to it. Not a huge number of people turned out to vote, I mean, I think the overall vote was under 3,500. So, you know, that's only a small portion of the entire university. But, you know, it's pretty rare, I think, for a second vote, to pass.
We'll see how that plays out as we enter 2018. Again, we've been talking with Larry Gordon. He is a senior correspondent with EdSource covering the issue of fees at the CSU system, and in particular, this rejection earlier this year by Fresno State students of a new fee that would have paid for a new student union. It'll come back later in 2018. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and ask, will Fresno reverse course on the issue of legal commercial marijuana businesses in the city? Clint Olivier will join us to talk about that and more, all coming up right after this. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We're just weeks away from recreational marijuana becoming legal in California. The passage of Proposition 64 led to cities across the state passing their own laws about regulating the industry. Some communities in the Valley, like Coalinga, Arvin, and Hanford, have welcomed the new pot businesses, but others, like the city of Fresno, have thus far banned commercial distribution. But in the case of Fresno, that could change. The city council is set to take up this issue of amending zoning laws to allow such businesses this Thursday. If approved, it would mark a reversal from the council's vote in September. Here to tell us more is Council President Clint Olivier. Clint, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you have two co-sponsors of this legislation this time, council members Oliver Baines and Paul Capriolio. Capriolio was on the opposite side when this issue last came to a vote on the commercial portion of the issue back in September. How did you get him on board for this one?
Well, I think there are a few things working in the city of Fresno. I think the biggest catalyst for this is the comprehensive ban that Councilmember Bredefeld brought forward. I think it was in the spring of this year. I think it was the biggest catalyst for this. And this is something that I formulated over the past maybe 48 hours. I finally was able to put my finger on it because I think it is truly earth-shattering that we're seeing this reversal, not just a reversal in votes, which I hope we can achieve that, but a reversal in political climate in such a short time. I think if I had put this agenda item on first, if I had said, okay, let's open up the city of Fresno to this commercial activity, let's foster a new industry, let's decimate criminal gangs, let's put money in the general fund, I don't think I would have had the votes. It's the fact that the ban came forward first. It fostered a different kind of discussion where good people said, you know what, wait a minute. No, I think I want to change my mind. I think we can proceed a different way. And so this is where we're at for this Thursday. And if it passes with the help of Councilmember Capriolio being one of those good folks who just said, you know, wait a minute, let's take a look at all sides. Let's take a look at the benefits of doing this. We want to get rid of criminal gangs and let's change our minds and the way we operate in the city of Fresno. It's a really big deal.
So exactly what would this resolution that you're proposing go before the council Thursday do?
Well, the reason why we're doing it is because to get a state license to operate in this space within the cannabis industry, to get a state license, you have to approach them with a license from the city. The municipality in which you wish to operate. And so that was really the impetus for this, was to license in a very loose way, maybe even just issuing a provisional declaration of allowing you to do business kind mm-hmm. of thing, so that our operators can take that to Sacramento and get in line to get the state license and then come back to us. By the time they come back to us, we're the consultant, which was a huge victory, 90 days ago, the consultant that the city of Fresno is hiring to help us craft the appropriate regulations, that consultant will have made his or her recommendations, and we will be in a place where we can not just license, but we can get folks open. And when I say folks open, I know that part of the stigma is a problem of optics. And a problem of optics is when you think of a cannabis user, you think of the cannabis user of the past. You think of Cheech and Chong. You think of Bill and Ted. You think of a stoner. You think of somebody who can't get up off the couch to work a job because they're a loser. But nothing could really be further from the truth. And so when I say, when we say cannabis operators, we're not just talking about retail operators. We're talking about manufacturing. We're talking about production. We're talking about distribution. We're talking about business. The kind of people who are running these businesses are not stoners with a backpack selling weed. The kind of people who have entered this industry, who have entered this space, are folks who used to be the CEO of manufacturing firms and the CEO of supply companies and, I mean, national corporations. So these folks are now entering this space. The reason why we have to act now is because infrastructure is going in. When you introduced me, you brought up, you know, three or four cities, Coalinga and Hanford and these other places. Business people are making major investments into communities here in the Valley. And so the ones that obviously they've gravitated toward are the ones who have set up a structure for in which they can operate. We need to do that in Fresno, and we have to do it quick before that infrastructure goes someplace else and those dollars of investment go someplace else.
So you're worried about Fresno being left behind financially in some way here?
It will be. I think that the A-game players, your reputable business people, your folks with palpable amounts of money to invest, they're looking for a place to invest now. And if Fresno were to wait 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, we would see those investors choose other communities. I want to be the bully. I want to be the 800-pound gorilla in the room. I want Fresno to be the place where we're providing jobs for people, where we're fostering a new industry, where we're decimating criminal gangs, and where we're putting money into the general fund to provide valuable services and needed, much needed services for a poor community like Fresno. I want to put that money in our general fund. I don't want that money to go into Bakersfield's general fund. I don't want it in Visalia's general fund. I want the investment here in Fresno, where it's really needed the most in the Valley.
So I want to unpack some of the issues that are involved with this. If this is approved by the city council, which it appears could very well happen Thursday, this doesn't immediately legalize these businesses to begin operating that day in Fresno. You're talking about changing the zoning laws, and that's a whole process. What does that involve, and what type of timeline would that take?
It could take, well, what it involves is our professional city staff rewriting our zoning laws, basically, to allow this activity.
So where you
city.
Want it, and what types
exactly.
of businesses.
And so this could take 90 days. It could take more than that. There have been these kinds of text amendments that have been approved by council that maybe were not all that popular with the administration that get on a stuck on a shelf. Oh, yeah, we're working on that. However, in this case, places are not going to start springing up overnight, although I think it's important that we note that we have two dozen retail storefronts that sell cannabis, and we also probably have 35, 40 delivery services operating in the city of Fresno.
That are presently illegal.
They're operating. We want them to pay taxes. We want them to be legitimate so that that we can undercut criminal gangs and put criminal gangs out of business. So my hope is that when the consultant comes online, works with professional city staff, we can see this come back in 90 days, 120 days. And that's when we're going to be able to answer more questions, unpack more, where we're talking about where storefronts are going to be located, where cultivation sites are going to be located. Obviously, there will be council members that have concerns and rightly have concerns about where these kinds of places will be located. Those are the kinds of things that we can go and work out in greater detail later and when the process begins. This is just kicking off that process.
Is there a risk here potentially if you're handing out these provisional licenses to businesses so they can get their foot in the door with the state, and then later on maybe the city in some way decides, well, maybe we don't want that particular category of marijuana business. Is there a potential risk there that the city has in some way given a go-ahead? If are you foregoing potential restrictions down the road by handing out provisional licenses right now?
Well, no. And I don't know if necessarily handing out provisional license is the correct characterization of what we're going to do. There are a number of different opinions as to what the state needs to issue their license. Now, the state is only giving 120-day licenses. And so that means the city of Fresno, I mean, we could give a 120-day license to operate, and then that would clock out. I mean, so we have to proceed carefully. We have to be cautious. I don't think that it would be appropriate to for our community to just let folks go crazy Wild West, only because there are. Obviously, we all live together. There are schools and churches and those kinds of things. And I also know that within the industry, the operators are very understanding of those kinds of things. So I think that we have to allow our folks to get in line in Sacramento. That's what we're going to do on Thursday. And then that will buy us the time that we need to put these regulations in place so that we can have a safe and healthy community and in which we can welcome these kinds of operators into our community. And you know, I wanted to add one other thing too. When you asked me what happened in the interim, what changed, I think the issue of the medicinal cannabis is really what swayed Member Capriolio. I mean, he would have to come on and explain it for himself and why he's moving to the place he's moving to. But I think that, and speaking for all my colleagues, I think it's very safe to say that when we had veterans who struggle with PTSD, we have people who are amputees come to council, we have people who are struggling with other problems related to military service, I think that really touched a lot of people who, as we've said earlier, the optics of Bill and Ted and the optics of Cheech and Chong, you don't really have a lot of compassion for somebody who's stoned all the time and won't go work a job. Those kinds of folks, God love them, but they're not exactly good poster children for what we're trying to do. What we want to do is we want to provide medicinal retail storefronts at this point in the city of Fresno, not recreational, not adult use storefronts. It's not what we're doing Thursday, but we want to provide access for patients, legal. There's access now, but it's illegal. It's black market. We want to bring this into the sunlight, make them these folks who need cannabis as medicine a part of our community.
So you need 4 votes to make this move forward. You have 3 co-sponsors. That other vote, doing the back of the math calculations from the previous time this came to the council, it's likely you could get that 4th vote and move this forward. Have you talked to Mayor Brand, though, about this? How does he feel? He's been an opponent.
He has. And so 4 votes, obviously it's not veto-proof. I'd love to get 5 or 6 votes on Thursday, and I think that's a possibility. Call your council member. Mayor Brand is someone who is on record as someone whose life has been detrimentally affected by drug use. In his family and among people who he loves. And so I know that the mayor is a very thoughtful person. He's concerned about drug abuse. He's concerned about gateway drugs. And so I'd love to hear the mayor on this program talking about that. But I think that the mayor is going to the mayor wants to hear from the consultants. The mayor wants to learn more about the industry. I think that he's interested. Obviously, economic development is his number one push in our city. I think that this has a role to play in that. So I have spoken to him. He has been, all I want to say about our mayor is that he's very interested in what the council does. He's not out there, screaming, I'm going to veto. He's not out there screaming, this is what we need. He's a pragmatic leader, and as I've said before, he's the right guy in the right place at the right time for us. So I'm hoping that when the council acts, that the mayor will not veto. I'm hoping that that he will continue to be curious as to what a new industry could bring to our city in terms of jobs and tax revenue, and I'm hoping that he'll be curious to hear what the consultants have to say. And so I think when at the end of the day, I'm hoping that we do earn the mayor's support.
And vetoes have been relatively rare, at least on non-budget items at City Hall. So we'll have to see where that goes. What about Chief Jerry Dyer? Have you talked to him? And if so, what was his response on this issue?
I did speak with Chief Dyer in a meeting at City Hall. I think this may have been 60, 90 days ago. Chief Dyer, we have not had a one-on-one conversation on this issue. He's a very busy guy. But he said, you know, you policymakers make the laws, and I will enforce them. And so I know that Chief Dyer has spent a lifetime fighting crime in neighborhoods. I know he's fought drug dealers, drug sellers, and drunk drivers. And I know that he's done a fantastic job with all that. But you know, apart from the issue of our police chief, I think that there are folks who have spent a life in service, who have spent a life in law enforcement and public service, who are coming to the realization that, look, we've got 60 cannabis outlets in the city of Fresno operating right now. You can go on weedmaps.com and pull them up and find out where they are. And you can have it delivered to your home the same time as it takes to get a pizza. So I think people who've spent a lifetime in government service and law enforcement are realizing that there is an alternative way. And we've tried everything else. Now the people have voted twice for cannabis. 20 years ago, they voted for medical cannabis. Now they voted Prop 64 a year ago. And so I think that folks are realizing, you know what, maybe there is a different way. Maybe there is a better way. You look at the video of the disaster that was the prohibition in the 1920s, prohibition of alcohol. Nobody quit drinking. It just made alcohol consumption more fashionable, made going out to the speakeasies fun and sexy and intriguing. It's the same thing with marijuana prohibition as well. And I think that when we bring that out into the light, when we cut out criminal gangs, decimate them, and we put some money in the general fund and create some jobs too, I think it's going to be healthy for our society. And I think that law enforcement professionals throughout the state and nation and the world are starting to realize that.
Now, you also have critics of this issue on the city council last September when this came up. Councilmember Bredefeld, who's a very staunch opponent of this, was directing comments at you saying, do you want these houses that explode and where people are doing hash oil production on their own? This is what's going to happen if this becomes law. Where is he wrong?
Well, I mean, he's
we're having that right now also.
Well, I think he's completely wrong. I don't think that it's a valid intellectual argument to scream for the children, for the children, for the children. I don't think it's a valid intellectual argument to scream culture war, culture war, because we have to be pragmatic and intelligent, and we have to be very deliberate in what we do. Now, I'm a conservative Republican Christian too. And there are a lot of folks that have taken issue with my policies. But it's interesting that here you have somebody who's a, you know, a conservative Republican who's actually championing this. That's because it's not a and I mean, yeah, I know when people think of me, they also think libertarian because I do come from the Ron Paul wing of the Republican Party. But the reality is it's not a conservative position to bury your head in the sand and just pretend, you know, like they have done at Fresno County, and just pretend, oh, we voted to ban it. There's no problem. You know what? Me worry. And that's not a conservative position to shovel money at law enforcement, good money after bad, to shovel money at the criminal justice system, good money after bad. I mean, you can steal $950 worth of stuff from Target and wheel it out and nothing will happen to you. And so we have a problem with criminal justice in the state of California. And so I think that compounding that are having a law enforcement chasing after what's going to be a legitimate industry in the next in the next 3 weeks, and that's what the voters have wanted. So I think that it's what's really the conservative position is to create a new, help foster a new industry that's going to create jobs, help beef up the general fund. And let our law enforcement and code enforcement and city attorneys work on other more serious issues than chasing after people with cannabis.
Before we go today, I want to shift gears really quickly and turn to one other issue that's before the council on Thursday, and that's the pay of city council members. You're termed out of office here very shortly, but your colleague Oliver Baines is advancing a proposal that would give future city council members a raise. Where do you stand on this?
Two words, no way.
Why so? Everyone else got a raise, or at least a lot of other people at City Hall got a raise since the last time the city council did. I'm sure there's many people out there listening right now who feel the same way you do, but I know that there will be an argument that the city council deserves more compensation.
Well, sure, we deserve more compensation. So do you, Joe. So does everyone deserves more compensation. We're all overworked and underpaid. The reality is, you know what? This is public service, and I think I make a fortune. You know that? I live in a zip code where the average household income for my neighbors is $26,000 a year, and you pay me $65,000. I'm a rich man, and I'm making a fortune to do this. And it's an honor to do this. Let me tell you about a friend of mine. His name is Mark Kersey. He's a city council member in the city of San Diego. Mark has council meeting Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then on Thursday he has to be in committee meetings all day long. Then on Friday, he goes to the district, and he's out in the district. City of San Diego, they're working this guy to death, right? He makes $75,000 a year. You mean to tell me that we need to go up over what they're paying guys in San Diego? It doesn't make any sense. And I think that we're great right where we're at.
We'll see how that plays out, as well as the vote on marijuana zoning for the city of Fresno. We thank Clint Olivier, council president, for joining us today. Clint, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to come in.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A committee of California lawmakers is working toward a universal health care plan that would cover all state residents. On Monday, they heard from policymakers in other states who have attempted to launch similar models. Capital Public Radio's Sammy Keola reports.
When former Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin abandoned his proposed single-payer health plan in 2014, he said the costs were just too high. In September, he told a panel at Harvard this.
The lesson is, I was wrong. I don't think small states can go it alone, at least little states like Vermont, with an unstable federal partnership.
So the question is, can California do what Vermont couldn't? Jim Wood is the Democratic Assemblyman who co-chairs the new committee.
Vermont went further than anyone. San Francisco, you know, created a very different model. And so this is all a big learning experience. We need to learn this. This is really critical information for us, so we can craft what is the best way forward for California.
Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon convened the committee after blocking a Senate single-payer proposal that was expected to cost the state $400 billion annually. Linda Blumberg is a senior health policy fellow at a D.C.-based think tank called the Urban Institute. She says Vermont's mistake was trying to move too quickly from a system where people pay premiums for their own plans to one where they pay high taxes to a public insurance pool. She recommends California tackle it in pieces.
So that we're moving in a direction of more uniformity, we're moving in a direction of greater access and affordability, but we're doing it in steps instead of something that would be really a huge change and disruptive and very expensive on the public ledger side, all in one big move.
The Universal Coverage Committee will hold a third hearing in early 2018. In Sacramento, I'm Sammy Keola.
California Treasurer John Chung is trying to strike a balance in his run for governor between support for progressive policies and an image of fiscal prudence. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler recently sat down with the treasurer to hear his thoughts.
We're joined by State Treasurer John Chung, a Democratic candidate for governor. Welcome.
Happy to be with you.
Of all the candidates that are running right now, four Democrats, including yourself, two Republicans, why do you think you would be the best of all of them?
Integrity and effectiveness. You know, who's doing the job that you get elected to? Who's focused on making sure that Californians have the best state, whether it's healthcare, education, job creation, and who's going to fight for them every moment of the day?
Is that a contrast to some of the other candidates?
Yeah, clearly.
How so?
If you look at who's been fighting, we have a housing crisis in the state of California. Had the good fortune as the state treasurer to increase over the past few years new and rehabilitated housing development by 126%. We can promise what we're going to do as governor, but the, you know, where have you been and why haven't you worked on it?
Let's begin the discussion by talking about the congressional tax reform bill in Washington. So the president and Congress appear pretty likely to pass an overhaul of the federal tax code in the coming weeks. As a Democrat, I'm sure you oppose the bill. As a Californian, you're probably concerned about some of the provisions that would limit how much state and local taxes could be deducted. But I'd like to ask you a practical question. If it passes, and if, as seems likely, it has some effect on California's economy and the state budget, what would you do as governor to offset those impacts?
Well, it's a massive cost shift, you know, to shorten what you pointed out. And again, back to that original point of integrity, you know, we talk about how we're going to take on President Trump. I offered specific ideas on how do you take on President Trump in what particular areas. Again, in regards to housing, the House bill included the elimination of the tax deductibility of private activity bonds. I know it's technical, but we finance two-thirds of our affordable housing in the state of California through the use of private activity bonds. Do you not want increased healthcare costs? Right, we use those private activity bonds to build hospitals, airports, other types of infrastructure here in the state of California. And so what are we going to do? When President Trump took office, we looked at a loss of funding for community clinics. Community clinics here in the state of California serve one in every seven Californians, principally women, women of color, low income. As the state treasurer, I found some money. We went to the legislature, repurposed that money so that we could provide some seed funds to community clinics so that they can try to figure out how they're going to keep their doors open in the era of President Trump. So real specific solutions to address the critical issues impacting Californians.
And so looking at that, what do you do if a hole is blown in the state budget and the economy starts to turn sour? If, as seems likely at this point, the tax bill gets through?
I've been there. Right, I was the state controller that helped California during those very difficult financial straits. The ratings agencies put in their state credit reports. We liked the way the controller, that was me back then, handles money. I pushed for greater accountability and transparency. Unfortunately, when the governor and legislature don't make the difficult decisions, we run out of cash or we run low on cash. That's when I had to issue 450,000 IOUs to the tune of $2.6 billion to try to prevent California from defaulting on debt. Right? What I would immediately do is that I bring all the legislative leadership and all the most active partners in regards to the education community, the healthcare community, the corrections communities, where we spend the three largest categories of our general funds, into the room and saying, you know, we're going to have to work together to try to get California through these difficult times.
But how? I mean, are there specific? Do you need to look at cuts? Do you need to look at taxes?
You have to look at everything on the table, right? So, you know, during that last time, think about it. 5 years ago, we were still in financial crisis. Now, much to the credit of Governor Brown. You know, we communicated to Governor Brown 5 years ago in 2012. We were running short of cash, right? They were going to have to do something so that we didn't have another 2009 situation. He worked with the relative interested parties to make sure that we got through those difficult times. They made spending cuts. They also passed tax increases, Proposition 30. And so today, California has made great progress in regards to addressing our financial situation. That's something else I would aggressively push. We still have long-term obligations, and they are hefty. And so I want to make sure that California continues to be fiscally responsible to address the critical issues so that when we have that next downturn in the economy, it's not going to be as painful as it could be.
One of the things that you did during the budget crisis that drew praise and criticism was you docked lawmakers' pay when in the first year that Jerry Brown was governor, 2011, he vetoed a budget that they sent over saying, as you agreed, that it wasn't balanced. Now, under Proposition 25, voters passed just before that. That was what gave you the power to do so. But then when the legislature challenged you in court, not to recoup pay for that instance, but to set the precedent for future, court said, no, you were wrong.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So I was trying to enforce the will of the voters of California. The California voters were frustrated that year after year, the governor and legislature did not come up with a timely and balanced budget. And so when the voters passed Proposition 25, we interpreted that they had to pass a timely, balanced budget. And the budget wasn't balanced. The very next day, Governor Brown said, this budget's out of balance. I'm going to veto it. We enforced what they said. The judge said, hey, the legislature gets to decide. The person who decides it's unbalanced is also the governor can. And we said, in fact, the governor did declare that it was unbalanced and he vetoed it. As governor, I would do the same thing. And I would act early. And frankly, a difference in leadership style, I would bring in the legislature so we wouldn't get to that point, saying this is what we need to do. Let's work on and identify our priorities. Education, healthcare, job creation, the environment are absolutely critical to me. Let's not get to that point where we wait till the very last minute and pass things that don't work.
We're talking with State Treasurer John Chung, one of four Democrats running for governor next year to replace termed out Governor Jerry Brown. On health care, many progressive Democrats strongly support single-payer health care. When asked about single-payer at a previous candidate forum back in October, you talked about phasing it in gradually rather than all at once. But I don't know if I actually heard you that day say whether you support or oppose single-payer health care. So what is your position on it?
So two things. I support universal care. I believe all Californians should be covered. And I support the approach of single-payer. They want to eliminate the inefficiencies that exist in the system. So I support both. You also raised that point, and I said that I want to make sure that we're truthful with the residents of the state of California, right? How much is it going to cost? Anytime you're going to change the systems or you're going to provide services or programs, I think what's important is that we are transparent, we're accessible, and we're accountable. And if we're going to bring in a new healthcare system, then we ought to tell people how much it's going to cost and how we're going to pay for it.
How much would it cost? How would you pay for it?
Well, part of it is we're going to have to measure the services going forward, right? That's what you had with the Affordable Care Act. There was a huge debate as to what services would be included, what not would not be included, right? They included 10 core areas. We're going to have to decide if we're going to have 10 core areas. Are we going to have 15 core areas? Are we going to have 7 core areas? And then price it out, look at individual line items such as Medi-Cal reimbursement rates. Are we going to keep them? Are we going to increase them? How that changes the equation, and then, you know, how much the current system brings in. And we're going to have to be truthful, right? The huge component of this is we get tens of billions of dollars from the federal government. And with the discussion and debate taking place in Washington, D.C., whether they give us the current amount or the discussion's, 70% of the amount, or will they go back to historical reimbursement or amounts at 50%? That is a huge unknown, and so that ought to be part of the debate and discussion, depending on how much we're going to get in contributions from the federal government, what services are we going to provide, how much of it are we going to cover, 10%, 100%, right, clarity, and then put that system in place.
So, of course, single payer and universal are not the same. Universal right. is where everyone is covered, and single payer is there is a single provider, right?
That's
a
correct.
A single payer of healthcare. You support both?
Yes.
Is there a way within the realm of single payer that you want to do it that you think could earn more support than maybe some of the proposals out there now?
We'll have that discussion, right? We're going to have to bring in the interested parties, right? The speakers having those hearings, trying to fully put meat on the bones as to what would be required for single payer. I would review all those notes, have separate conversations, right? Have my senior staff work on all those things to see where we can find common ground. That's what leadership is, bringing people to the table, hammering it out.
The issue dominating California politics and government right now, not far from us here at the state capitol, is the issue of sexual harassment.
Yes.
Just this week, the cover of Time magazine had a California lobbyist who is one of the leaders of the letter with more than 100 women who signed it that really kicked off this issue in discussion here in Sacramento. And that has led to 3 lawmakers so far being named by women as having sexually harassed or assaulted them. Talk about what you believe must be done in Sacramento and in California politics as a whole.
Well, clearly we are going to have to change the culture. You've had past practices where they have allowed for abuses, where women have not felt secure, where they haven't felt supported, where they don't feel that they have access to the resources. We haven't had the proper education that has connected with individuals to transform and change their behavior. And so I'm going to be incredibly tough, right? As you pointed out, I'm the first, and hopefully others will join me in putting forward a policy to address sexual harassment, not only to change the culture in Sacramento, but to change the culture in the United States of America, right? We have to have zero tolerance.
One of the things that's been remarkable so far in this gubernatorial campaign is the lack of personal attacks among the candidates. At the candidate forum that I covered this fall, the most I heard was one candidate characterize another's support for single payer as pie in the sky. But recently, you launched what I believe is the only attack website so far in this race, which is attacking the frontrunner, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. Why did you put that site up?
Right, it's not our, you know, our interpretation of things. Right, the you know, that first piece was comparing and contrasting financial management leadership skills in the state of California. So, you know, that first piece we used from a independent journalist, not affiliated with the campaign, printed a long time ago, citing the San Francisco Comptroller's review of the management and accountability practices of San Francisco. We ought to have a healthy debate and discussion about what we offer, what our vision, what our track record, what our experience is. And so we said to individuals, take a look at the article, right? And you can draw your own conclusions.
Finally, Treasurer Chung, the latest poll shows that you're in a third-place tie at 9% with Gavin Newsom at 23%, former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa at 18%. How do you catch up?
Well, we're in tied for fourth place. Number one is undecided, right? You have a huge swath of the voters who, frankly, haven't paid attention. They're focused on other types of issues. Gavin's numbers, right, he's ahead, but his numbers are dropping. Antonio is slightly increasing, and so we feel good, right? In campaigns, you start to move the numbers when you start spending money, and we think we have a very compelling message, right? The only person who has served in all three financial offices, who fought for California, the Democrat who stood up, progressive on social issues, and also who can balance a checkbook, right? And I think my values, my philosophy, my work building more housing, financing education is going to resonate very strongly with the voters of California.
State Treasurer John Chung, formerly state controller, former member of the Board of Equalization, as you referenced there, one of four Democrats running for governor next year. Thank you for coming in.
Happy to spend time with you.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we want to know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us @KVPR and @Valley Edition. You can also find our podcast and our audio archives at kvpr.org as well. For Valley Edition's reporting crew of Laura Tsutsui and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. Thank you.